Hi, welcome back to the Incidental Economist Podcast. This is our fifth podcast. Today's date is September 2nd, 2011. You're joined by me, Aaron Carroll, and Austin Fracht.
Yes, and today we're going to talk about political feasibility. And there's two angles to that. One is, what does it mean for something to be politically feasible, and when it might not, and why? And the other is, what are some of the issues in health policy or proposals for reform that may or may not be politically feasible? So, Aaron, which do you want to start with?
Let's start with the first. Let's start with what it means for something to be politically feasible.
Okay, so I don't know how many people recognize that Congress and the government can't just do anything at any time, because there's so many different voices and interests involved. And it's both within the government and outside the government. I'm talking about in health. I'm talking about interested groups like hospitals and physicians and so forth.
Yeah, and I'm always impressed too at how many people get angry just because the president doesn't do X.
Exactly.
The president doesn't do Y. As if he's king.
Can't he just lead? Yeah, can't he just lead and say, we're going to do thus and such, and Congress go figure it out?
Why doesn't he make jobs? Or why doesn't he make abortion illegal?
Yes.
Or why doesn't he fix Social Security? The president is not king.
No, he's not king. There's to do many things, not everything, but do many things, you need 60 votes in the Senate because of the filibuster. And you need, obviously, majority in the House, too, which is not always easy. And that goes for healthcare. And each of those individuals comes from a state or even a smaller region, you know, a district. And that state or district has its own interests and priorities, or people in it, or industries in it. And so the individual wants to be elected, again, naturally. They need campaign financing. So they're just not going to get into line behind anything the president says every time, and nor are they necessarily going to do what Aaron thinks is the right thing to do, even though Aaron's really smart.
They should, but they
don't.
Yeah,
they should.
I don't understand.
Really should.
But, you know, I think it's actually worth spending a tiny bit more time explaining a thing about the filibuster, because it's not what the Constitution says.
Yep.
The Constitution says for a law you got to have a majority of the House, you got to have a majority of the Senate, and then the president has to sign it. And we won't get into veto at this point. But because there are rules that have been written outside the Constitution in the Senate, and they have changed over time, many, many times, you actually have to have 60 votes in the Senate to overcome what they call a filibuster. But it's not like old-timey filibusters like they have in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where a senator can
Great
get
film.
Up and just talk forever. Basically, you have to have 60 votes to proceed. And if you can't get 60 votes to proceed, you can't. So it's not that they can stop by delaying things. They can just say, we're not going to let things proceed. And that's how a filibuster works today. And this last Congress has used the filibuster an unprecedented amount of times, making it effectively impossible to advance legislation in the Senate unless you have 41 senators. No, wait, I'm getting that backwards. It's effectively impossible to advance legislation unless you have 60 senators who say, let's go forward.
And this is, like you said, this is by the rules that the senators in that Congress have agreed to. They could change the rules, but they set the rules, or they continue them from the past, and they abide by them.
And part of the reason that they continue them from the past is because they all enjoy having that sort of power in the minority. And they recognize, since they're there for a long time, most of them, that control of the Senate waxes and wanes. And so nobody seems willing to change the rules or give that up. But it means that you must have 60 votes to pass. And what's critical, and what people I think often miss, is that those votes in the middle, like the 55th through 60th senator from the Democratic Party right now, they are from conservative states. They are, you know, elected out of Republican states, for that matter. And so they're very lucky that in conservative states, they are Democrats who've been elected. You can't attack them from the left. You know, it's not as if you push them from the left that they're going to get more likely to be elected in their states. They're not fools.
Right.
You know, Ben Nelson in Nebraska knows that if he runs to the left, he will lose his seat because he's from a Republican state. He can only really move to the right. And so arguments which, you know, advance, you know, progressive causes and try to scream at conservative senators that they're not liberal enough will fall on deaf ears. You just can't do that.
Right. So this explains why the health reform law, among many others, tends to drift more and more in the conservative direction as it gets developed, and why things like the public option fell away, and other things, you know, why the subsidies are not as high as they would be otherwise. Sometimes capturing the 60th Democratic vote is harder than capturing a few moderate Republicans. There may not be many these days, and there certainly weren't any voting for health reform, but it is often the case, or it was, that you could catch a few Republicans before you caught the last Democrat.
And again, that's an excellent point, and for a good reason, because a lot of those moderate Republicans are from more Democratic states. I mean, a Scott Brown from Massachusetts only increases his reelection chances by moving to the left, because yeah, that will make him look better to Democrats. So you can, ironically enough, attack, you know, moderate Republicans sometimes from the left more easily than you can conservative Democrats. And that's hard for people to understand, but it's a key issue with trying to get legislation passed in a feasible manner.
So should we talk about the effect of this on health reform itself a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I remember, and I'm sure many people do, there were months and months and months of discussion about the public option, which ultimately was never included in health reform because of Joe Lieberman. As those months went on, actually the nature of the public option changed quite a bit. Initially the idea was it would be a public plan that set rates that it would pay to providers based on Medicare's rates. And then later that fell away, where it was still a public plan, but it would negotiate rates just like any other.
And it was national back then too.
It was a national plan. Right. And so once it became a plan that had to negotiate rates, the distinction that it was a public plan actually started to not really matter that much. And CBO dramatically changed the number of people they thought would enroll in it, because the premiums would be higher if it wasn't tying what it had to pay to Medicare. Mm-hmm. And at that point, many people, many policy analysts and policy wonks and so forth, said this fight over the public option in this form, where it's now not even going to enroll that many people, is becoming a huge distraction. And those out there who are saying they won't vote for this or they won't support it because if it doesn't include a public option are missing 90% of the picture of what health reform is. The public option is a very narrow point.
And I actually always made the argument, even back then, that this bill was about access. This bill was about trying to get more people coverage. Not one more person in the United States likely would have had health insurance because there was a public option.
Right.
That just wasn't what it was about. The public option was thought to be some method of cost control, of sort of forcing everyone to have, to bring their costs down to match what the government could achieve. So I'm fine with that in terms of cost control, but most of the people who were screaming and yelling about a public option and getting angry about it were not worried about cost control.
No.
They were worried about access.
Well, I think they were thinking of something else. I think they were thinking that this is the foot in the door towards single payer or Medicare for all. A lot of people felt that way. This is the least we could do. And that's why they were so passionate about it, even if it was so watered down. They just wanted some structure there that looked like maybe that could be expanded in the future.
That's crazy. I mean, I don't want to say that's crazy.
That's a really good segue to the political feasibility of single payer, which I have hinted at in my post this week. Although when I think of political feasibility, I'm not just thinking of ideas on the left. I'm also thinking on the right. I'm thinking of all ideas.
Sure.
So single payer is an interesting question, whether it's politically feasible or under what conditions it would be, because it is happening in Vermont. So you have an example.
Yeah. Well, I think this is also where I think this is where maybe you and I start to disagree about political feasibility, because I don't see a problem in advocating for things that can't be passed today because they might get passed someday in the future. I mean, come on, no one is under the illusion that this House of Representatives is going to pass a national single-payer plan. For that matter, this Congress, I mean, the Senate's not going to pass a national single-payer plan. But that doesn't mean it can't ever happen. Because that was exactly the rhetoric that was used against Medicare back in the day.
Well, how long? How long till it happens?
it took a long, again, this is a long game. It's a marathon. And mm-hmm. so I think that there's a difference between advocating for things which could happen someday and advocating for things which will happen right now. I would not have burned the house down for health care reform in the PPACA because we couldn't get single payer then. In other words, that was not politically feasible then. However, I think constantly dismissing single payer arguments is that will never happen ever because it's not politically feasible. I don't think that that's accurate, as you're seeing in Vermont and as we saw with Medicare over the course of decades.
Well, I think we do differ, although it is a nuance, and it's that I certainly would never say that any policy is impossible. You know, there's going to be some configuration someday if the republic lasts long enough, under which any number of policies would be possible, from single payer on the left to, you know, Paul Ryan's concept of Medicare on the right. You know,
sure.
You can always imagine the right forces that would bring those to play. However, it is extremely hard for me to see in anything like the foreseeable future, something like actually either of those ideas that I just mentioned happening. It's both are such a radical departure from current arrangements. It's just hard for me to imagine.
I'm not arguing that. Yeah. I'm not saying that this would. In other words, if the world continues as it is today, I completely agree with you.
Well, not just as it is today, but in a wide variation around it. Look what it took to get the ACA passed, an unprecedented level of government control, not unprecedented, but not in many, many years, many decades, government control by one party. And still it was really hard to get something that was very centrist.
I agree. But yeah. I think if let's say that the recession double dips and let's say it gets much, much worse. And let's say we enter a depression even. And therefore, which one party, be it one side or the other, winds up in massive power because of total retaliation against the other party. I could see, if it was a very conservative party, them achieving something much closer to the Paul Ryan plan. I could see, if it goes the other way, achieving something much closer to the Democrat or to a single-payer type plan, much as what happened with, you know, Roosevelt and the New Deal after the Great Depression, you know, back in the 30s and 40s. Because with enough of a problem, you may see enough of a lopsided government one way or the other that something we would say is absolutely impossible today could pass.
I agree. And that's why these ideas should be discussed and thought about. And as I call it, each of these ideas I think of as an arrow. You should put these arrows in the quiver. Someday we're going to go to that quiver and want to pull it out, or somebody is. However, what I object to is a degree of focus on one of these out of the mainstream ideas, mainstream by current configuration of politics. Such a focus on it that it distorts the debate from away from things that can be achievable today and provide a huge benefit to many people. So I would hate to see. I really don't like to see people, or I would never do the following: say, if it's not single payer, I'm not interested, you know, or worse, I think I want this system to get so awful. I don't want to pass anything that might improve it, even marginally. I want it to get so awful that everybody realizes how right I was, you know, that we have to have this.
And I agree with you. And I think that there are people on both ends of the spectrum, ironically, who were willing for that to actually happen, who would see the government default to get what they want. And on the other side, would rather not see any incremental steps in healthcare reform because they want things to get so bad that they could get single payer. I agree with you there. But I think my issue is that I think it doesn't give us as Americans enough credit to say that, like, we can't focus on parts of the debate at different times. In the thick of healthcare reform, when it came to, like, getting those last
some people
few votes,
can do that and some seem not to be able to.
I have no problem. Yeah, in the thick of healthcare reform, I was one of the people that said, this is not the law that I would have written, but I think it will do more good than harm, and this is what we can achieve today. Let's do it. But I think never discussing single payer, for instance, you know, or I would even say never discussing something like Paul Ryan's plan, honestly, doesn't give us the breadth of choices we see. You need a Paul Ryan plan to see this is how the government can spend way less money, but you got to own the negative consequences for the elderly and how much cost sharing there will be that it will have. And you should understand that so we can decide if that's what we want.
Oh, with
single payer, we should own that, look, you can have a system which would probably pay a number of people less, which would have a much stronger ability to cost control, which would probably wind up bringing our spending much more in line with many other countries and would be much more feasible and conservative fiscally. But you got to own that it's politically, you know, not what a lot of people would do, that there would be a lot of sort of oversight and something along the lines of saying we're not paying for that. Yeah, perhaps less choice. You got to own that. You can't say it's Pollyanna. Everyone's going to have anything they want and somehow everything's going to be magic. There are negative consequences as well. And we should be able to say, but look how much we'd save and look how much utilitarian good we could do for the most number of people. So we should be able to have those discussions and not just say, dismiss this, dismiss that. I think it's an important part of the debate. But I think finally, when we decide how to negotiate, it's dangerous to say it's my way or the highway.
Yeah.
That's not a functioning government.
So, we actually agree 100%. It's just that you like to say the issue of start with A and get to B, and I like to start with B and get to A. In other words,
probably, yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, I agree. I think that there's probably more agreement between what we're saying than disagreement, but it does have implications along the lines of, you know, what should we allow to happen? Should we allow there to be debate? I think, should we even allow there to be experimentation?
Definitely, but with experimentation, because it's pretty clear there's a lot of uncertainty about the right way forward. However, when people talk about state experimentation, I think they should be clear about what the point is. If the point is to find models that work and then implement them either in other states or nationally, then at some point you have to stop experimenting and just say, well, that looks good and that looks good, so let's do that. And
yeah, but it takes us in certain directions. I mean, if Vermont does a single payer plan and it works, maybe other states should follow along those lines. If Rhode Island implements their block grants, and I totally would say that that's not, they're not implementing it the way that, you know, Representative Ryan mm-hmm. was recommending. But if a state, you know, tried to negotiate with the government like Rhode Island and got the block grant and proved that they could do a much better job, we should try to let more states do that, and then we should study that. We have to be willing to allow for experimentation in directions that might not necessarily always fit our political philosophies. It's why I'd argue that we even need to look overseas. As difficult as that is right now in the current environment, other countries do this differently, and the vast majority of them seem to be able to do it more cheaply, to achieve, you know, similar quality, and to cover significantly more people. There are things we could learn if we would be at least willing to have that debate and not necessarily dismiss it all as politically infeasible.
Well, absolutely. So that my question really is, you can always prolong this or maintain the status quo or even change things in the name of experimentation. So when do you say, well, you know what? We've learned an awful lot. Many nations have had variety of different systems over many decades. You know, we've learned from Massachusetts. I'm not saying today is the day we've learned enough, but when do you say, you know, we've done enough experimenting. We kind of know what we should do, and then you do something.
Yeah, I
don't know.
I wish our political system worked that way. I just don't think it does.
Well,
I think we have to do
doesn't.
Both things at the same time. I think we have to continually provide more data so that people can try to make better policy. And we have to accept that in the United States, the vast majority of policy happens pretty incrementally. We reelect our government every 2 years for the most part with Congress. So, you know, it's not – you can't engage in sort of long-term big deal things. Like, no law can take more than 2 years to pass – by far, because otherwise you're going to have a whole new government.
Right.
I think it just is a continual process.
Right.
And with that, we should probably, you know, wrap things up, recognizing that even this podcast has to have a finite amount of time.
Well, at least we solved everything. We're done.
Yes. Well, now we know how to proceed.
Yes.
So we're all
it's
good.
It's just 60 votes in the Senate.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back next week. Once again, it's Aaron Carroll and Austin Frack to The Incidental Economist. Have a great week.